Hello. I'd like to thank everyone for having me today. This is work I did in collaboration with Simeon Hellerman and John McGreevy, and the paper, as well as the title of the talk, is Geometric Constructions of Non-Geometric String Theories. Simeon gave a talk on this, it seems like forever ago, when we were starting the project and we actually hadn't done anything. So. The first half of the talk will kind of be reviewing what setting up what we were going to do, talking about some of the same things Simeon talked about, and then we actually have results now, so we'll finish up by telling you what those are. Start with a brief outline of what I'm going to talk about. I'll discuss the moduli problem a little bit and talk about monodromy and how you may possibly exploit monodromy and to get a solution to this problem. And then I'll discuss the semi-flat approximation, which is going to be our guiding principle in what we do here today. And then I'll talk about actually building non-geometric string theories. I'll talk a little bit about the supergravity and the actual construction of the spaces and a particular model we build. And then I'll say a little bit about the spectrum of that model and some dual models. And then you can go home. So, when you first start hearing about string theory, I don't know, from your ENMTA, or something. You start hearing, oh, there's this theory and it has no free parameters, and this seems very exciting, you know, there's no free parameters. But then you start actually learning about it and you realize, well, there's no free parameters, but there are all these moduli in your problem that have to get fixed somehow. So you've moved the question over to something dynamical, which is a big step, but actually lifting all these moduli is non-trivial. So for example, we know most string theories are described by some nonlinear sigma model, which Lagrangian looks something like this, and the beta function equations are going to, at low energy, just reduce to Einstein's equations on your target space, plus some higher order corrections. So specifically, if you have some metric, which is some low energy solution to these equations, some Ricci flat metric, and you scale it up, you still have a solution to the low energy equations of motion. In particular, these correction terms actually get scaled down if you're scaling up your metric. So you end up with a better solution than you started with to these low energy equations. So the overall volume of your space, if you have a solution, is a modulus of your theory. And you might think, well, we can just have some potential and it's going to fix this modulus someplace. But we know this can't be the case. The reason being is that the infinitely large radius, you're going to recover a 10-dimensional maximally supersymmetric string theory because you just have. So at infinitely large radius, you're going to recover the maximal supersymmetry, and these potentials are going to have to vanish. So they're not going to want to fix you at some finite volume. So how are we going to lift the volume modulus? Well, one idea is you can exploit stringy symmetries that don't commute with the scaling up of your metric. In particular, you can think about gauging T-duality. So of course, if you just think about T-duality on a circle, obviously if you T-dualize and scale up, that's not going to be the same thing as scaling up and then T-dualizing. So this isn't a new idea. This is kind of the idea behind asymmetric orbifolds. But what we do here is a little different. Is it a gauge symmetry? It's. It's a symmetry of the theory of once it's a symmetry of the theory, and then you can gauge it. I mean, in this sense of what we're going to be doing today, because we're in some sense by looking at the monodromy, like talking about it is local.
When you go to the enhanced symmetry point, isn't it an element of the enhanced gauge group that you get there?
Sure.
Yeah, so it is automatically a gauge symmetry.
Right, that's the usual argument.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's not that you can gauge it, it is.
Right, okay. So the model, so particularly today, I'm going to look at type 2A string theory compactified on a two torus. And we know in these compactifications, In particular, we're going to have our internal space be four-dimensional. We'll have a two-dimensional base with these T2 fibers. And we know that these T2 fibers can degenerate at certain points.
So it's only four compact?
We're only doing four compact dimensions.
Okay, and why? Make it apply for that?
So when we originally started the project, I think when Simi came, we were thinking about T3 fibers, and this proved very difficult for several reasons, which I can talk about a little bit at the end. So we did the T2 fibers, and we talk a little bit about that in our paper over the four-dimensional base, but I'm not going to discuss that today. But, you know, one of the things we want to do is try to extend this to a six-dimensional internal space, and I'll talk a little bit about that at the end. But this was the simplest thing to do, and it turned out to give some interesting physics. So we have two-dimensional base, and we have these T2 fibers, and we know these fibers can degenerate at certain points. So in particular, you're going to have some point in your base where, as you go around, you have some non-trivial loop. So we know that there's this symmetry group associated with the torus, and you don't have to come back to yourself up to yourself. You can always come back to yourself up to any dual version of yourself in this symmetry group.
Remind me, are you thinking about compact spaces which are smooth and just the fiber sort of which is degenerating, or is there actually a singularity?
In some cases there's a singularity, in some cases there's not. Okay. So, in particular, you can think about these spaces as kind of a space with a branch cut, and as you move around, you come back up to some dual version of yourself, but that's okay. But this isn't really a good enough. This is a nice way to lead your intuition, but the spaces we're going to be creating today, building today, are really stranger than this. And one of the ways to see this is you could imagine one of the elements of your symmetry group is just T-duality. So you can imagine you're a zero brain, and you move around in a circle, and when you get back to where you started, you're a two brain. So it's kind of strange. And other things can happen too, like you can come back to an anti-D0 brain or something like this.
Where is T-duality on both cycles?
It's T-duality on both cycles, right. All right, so this is what we're going to try to do, use to fix moduli. In particular, we know that these T2 fibers can degenerate at more than one point along the base. And the idea we're going to use is assume that far away from these points, we can trust the supergravity and then just use that to kind of glue these spaces together. And as you get close to these points where you have the fiber degenerating, you know that we understand the physics there in a way that I'll explain. You can understand them in some ADE classification. And you could, so we're going to replace the supergravity with the string physics we understand there. So this seems pretty reasonable. It's similar to things done in other situations. You might ask if this is legitimate because for particular cases, you can see, and I've kind of done an example here, that the curvature on the base is singular. And now this is just the curvature on the base. This isn't the curvature. So for this particular example, it's perfectly smooth. But the curvature on, if you just consider the two-dimensional curvature on the base, it's singular. So you might wonder if what we're doing is legitimate, but we're going to assume that it is, and then hopefully by the end of the talk, I've convinced you that it is. So this is kind of what we're going to do. Before I get started, I want to remind you about a few facts about torus compactifications that we're going to use throughout the talk. And they are simple things, we all know. In particular, the main focus of interest is going to be the symmetry group, or the part of the symmetry group we're interested in, which is this SL2Z cross SL2Z symmetry group. The first SL2Z here is the geometric symmetries of the torus, and the second one is B-field shifts and T-duality. And I've written the eight-dimensional effective action up here just as kind of a motivator for the symmetry group. I mean, you could, it's kind of, obviously, if you take this kinetic term here and let tau go to tau plus 1, it's a symmetry, and it's about half a line of algebra to show tau goes to minus 1 over tau is also that these kinetic terms are going to be invariant. So that's just a quick way to at least motivate that this is going to be the symmetry group of your torus. Now we might want to ask, what happens to the torus and the moduli under T-duality? And I've done a trivial example here where you look at, you consider rho and tau just to be purely imaginary. But this is unimportant. This is stuff we all know. I just wanted to remind you that if you T-dualize on one cycle, you're going to exchange rho and tau. And if you T-dualize on two cycles, rho is going to go to minus 1 over rho, and tau is going to go to minus 1 over tau. So let's get started. First thing we're going to look at is the supergravity. And I've written up here the Dilatino variations and the Gravitino variations. These, if we look at just the Dilatino and the Gravitino along the fiber, the equations of motion reduce to this here, mainly that rho is holomorphic and the dilaton satisfies this equation. So a few points to remember or notice are, recall 2A, always there always exists two spinners of opposite 10-dimensional chirality. And the 10-dimensional chirality can break up into the product of the 6 and 4-dimensional chirality. Also, the equation of motion along the fiber is going to preserve two spinners of the same 4-dimensional chirality. And this is actually pretty easy to see. So if we're looking at the Gravitino equation along the fiber, the derivative drops out. And once we project onto some state of definite chirality, this is just going to be some element of SU2. And therefore, it's going to be traceless. So if one of the eigenvalues is 0, the other eigenvalue is also going to be 0. So the two spinners of four-dimensional chirality are going to have the same eigenvalue. Also note that the chirality here, the six-dimensional chirality, is fixed by this equation of motion. So now we can ask what the 2A symmetries are. And we can see the general solution is going to have 1-0 supersymmetry in sixth dimension. And this is easy to see from the chi-10 having opposite chirality and chi-4 having the same, the two spinners we could possibly have would be either plus or minus. So this is going to be 1-1 supersymmetry. But then we notice from the equation of motion that it's fixed, and therefore we're only going to preserve one of those, so you have 1-0 supersymmetry. Now if you set rho constant, this goes away and chi-6 drops out of the equation, and we then can preserve 1-1 supersymmetry. Now we could have guessed that this was going to happen, because we know that type 2a compactified on a K3 has constant rho and preserves 1-1 supersymmetry. And similarly, you can say for constant tau, you preserve 2-0 supersymmetry. And the easiest way to see this is do the same argument we just did for rho in type 2b, except since type 2b has two 10-dimensional spinners of the same chirality, you're going to have 2-0 supersymmetry, and then T dualize, and you have type 2a with constant tau. So you might ask, you know, we had an intuition for what we were going to get for constant rho. Do we have a similar intuition for constant tau? And the answer is, of course, yes. Or I wouldn't have brought it up. So we might want to ask what these rho degenerations are. So in particular, consider a rho degeneration around which, when you move around, your monodromy takes rho to rho plus n. So we know close to that point, rho is going to look, you know, something like this. So clearly, if you let z go to z times e to the 2 pi I, this is just going to take rho to rho plus n. So then you can, so once we know this, we can measure the H flux as we go around this object. So in the full 10 dimensions, you have this six-dimensional object, and you're measuring the H flux around it, and you find out that it's just n. So you have this 5 plus 1-dimensional object with n units of NS fibrain charge, so it's these rho degenerations correspond to NS fibrains. And as I was just saying, we know in type 2a, in the presence of NS fibrains, the solutions have constant tau and preserve type 2-0 supersymmetry. So what about the Gravitino equations of motion along the base?
So these are there space filling?
Yeah.
All the directions are, the directions are along the full non-compact bifocal.
Yes, yes, because they're particles in the on the points on the base.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so now we want to ask about the Gravitino variations along the base, and we know, so the first thing we can do is go to conformal gauge on the base, and once we've done this, the equations of motion just reduce to this. So we want to know what the solutions to that is, and the easiest thing to do is to start guessing a solution until you have the right answer. And so the first guess is that we just take this in here to be zero. So we take phi to be this, but then we realize this can't be right because our theory has to be modular invariant. And this e to the 2 phi here is not going to be modular invariant. So we want to make it modular invariant. So what we can do is just multiply by eta functions until it is. So this is still going to be a solution because you're taking the natural log of this, and you can always break eta into holomorphic and non-holomorphic parts, sums of them. So if the d bar doesn't kill it, the d will. So this looks better. It's modular invariant. But now you have the problem of, at these degenerations, we know that these eta functions here are, they have zeros. And we can't have our metric disappearing all over the place. So we have to divide out by these zeros. And you get, if you look at the you know, form of the eta functions, you can show you just need to divide by this funny factor of 1/12 here. So this is just a product over all the tau degenerations you have, and this is all the rho degenerations you have. And at this point, the number we have is unfixed. So that's it for the supergravity. And now we have to actually worry about trying to construct spaces and understand the physics on them. And to do this, we're going to talk about these T2 fibers as elliptic curves. And although for many people here, this will probably be an unnecessary review, it's something that confused me forever, and I could never find it in any physics literature. And math literature tends to confuse me. So I thought I would give a 2-minute introduction to elliptic curves in the torus. So why do we want to talk about elliptic curves? Or why does it make sense to talk about elliptic curves, I guess, is the first thing I want to talk about. So we have some torus here, and you can talk, the torus you can always just talk about as some, you know, fundamental region in this complex plane with these periods, and you just have to have everything periodic. So if you want to think about the torus like this, you can define functions on it. In particular, you can define this pump function here, known as the Weierstrass P function. Zeta here is supposed to be the coordinate on the torus, and you're just doing this double infinite sum here. So clearly this is periodic. If you shift zeta by any integer number of these periods, you can always just absorb it and then relabel your indices, and you're done. But why am I particularly interested in this form of the equation? I could have had a 10 here or taken some function of this here, and you still would have had a valid equation on your torus. And the reason this is special is because it satisfies this condition. If you make this identification of x with p and y with the derivative of p, it turns out that x and y satisfy an equation which looks like this. And this is just the defining equation for an elliptic curve. The map isn't for, you can always, this is called Weierstrass normal form, and you can always get rid of the x squared term. But you have these two things describing your, these two moduli describing your torus, f and g, and it's not unique for each torus. So you could redo a coordinate, you could change your coordinates and always get a different, get h and p, say, and it would still describe the same elliptic curve. However, you can define something called the J invariant, which is just this particular combination, and for any single torus or single elliptic curve, the J invariant is going to be the same. So this J is also, you can just think about it in another context. This is just your modular function mapping you from the upper half plane mod SL2Z into C, into the complex plane. Actually, I think it's C star. So now we have some explicit mapping from the torus to an elliptic curve. So I can talk about elliptic curves instead of tori if I want. And since we're actually thinking about these as being fibrations, we can let f and g here just vary with some coordinate z, which I'm going to take to be the coordinate on the base, which we're going to want to be a sphere so that our total space is compact, so that our base is compact. Also, another thing is you can, it's pretty trivial to show, if you just embed this in CP2, you can just, you can show that degenerate points are spaces where this discriminant locus is zero. It's this particular combination. So the places where the torus degenerates is going to correspond to kinks in this elliptic curve, and you can find those by just satisfying this equation. So why is it beneficial to talk about elliptic curves? It's probably less intuitive, at least geometrically. And the reason is because a nice mathematician by the name of Kodaira came and did this wonderful classification where he related the order of the vanishing of these f and g and the discriminant to the monodromy, and then that to its the ADE classification of the singularity. So we this makes it easy to understand the physics near these degenerate points. And so don't get lost in the table right now. I know it's a little, just a lot of information, but I'll point to the parts which are important in a second. So if you recall our metric, if you imagine kind of shoving all the degenerate points and going to one side, going really far away, where you can just imagine all the degenerate points are on top of each other, the metric's going to look something like this, where n's going to be the total number of degenerations, rho and tau, and the 12th just comes from the 1/12th that was there before. So in particular, if you let n equals to 24, your metric looks like this, or in this new coordinate u, it just looks like this. So what do we have here? We have some, you have two coordinate patches, you know, with this transition function here, and mapping you from this metric to this metric, we know just from experience this is the sphere. So if we want our base to be compact, we're going to need to include 24 degenerations. So now let's go back to the table. And you might notice there's these different fiber types here, like 4 and 4 star, 3 and 3 star, and so forth. And each of them come with a total of 12 degenerations. So the order of the vanishing, the discriminant's 12 here for these two together, and 12 here, and so forth. So this is very suggestive. So the idea is, and what we're going to use to construct these spaces, is we're going to look, we're going to take two sets of 12, and then we have 24. And that's what we need if we want our base to be compact. And in particular, we're going to look at D4 singularities. And the reason we're going to do that is, maybe I'll make a little aside at this point.
Let's see, before you do that, we talked about the degeneration. Am I correct in thinking that the torus is simply pinching off? One of the circles is sort of pinching off? Or are things more complicated?
I think it depends on which, on what type of singularity you're interested in, what monodromy you have. The torus is going to be, it's hard for me to think about in terms of the tori. In terms of the elliptic curve, you can say, oh, I know there's going to be a kink. You know, you can take the gradient and it's going to be equal to zero at some point. So you can say, oh, I know there's going to be a kink in the elliptic curve somewhere where the normal vanishes. And then once I know that, you can talk about what's the order of that vanishing, which is what we're doing with Kodaira.
So the order of that is like the zero?
I mean, the zero of the degeneration.
How fast it vanishes when it comes to that.
Yes, exactly.
So it would all look like a pinching off, but it could pinch off much more quickly for a higher order.
Right.
Yeah. One way you can view a lot of these guys is as a combination of, if you have individual points where different cycles are collapsing, and you move those points together. So these more exotic guys could be, in some sense, a superposition of the 1-0 cycle pinching and a 1-1 cycle pinching, and so on.
We'll
pinching cycles like that.
So we'll discuss that. I mean, that's the way we're going to move around in the moduli space of solutions we have, is by resolving these singularities into different singularities and moving around. The specific model we discuss are these. We're going to take two sets of D4s.
Is there some easy way to see the connection between this and the geometry of the 5-brain?
So the geometry of the 5-brain comes from rho goes to rho plus a constant. So that's going to be one of these standard AN singularities.
Okay.
And it's a rho degeneration.
So the more you have more general degeneration, that's one of the things you said, right?
Right. So, I mean,
general singularities.
Yeah.
So what, in streaming terms, what are they? Are they two brains or something?
So what are Okay, so you're asking, like, what is the degeneration? We know the rho to rho plus n is a 5-rein.
Right.
What is the degeneration?
Yeah, what's locally the, what sort of resolves this locally in string theory?
In string theory.
Mm-hmm.
The 5-rein singularity, or more general ones where you include, like, T-dualities and stuff.
How do you know it is resolved? How do you know it's a string solution?
We'll discuss motivation for why we think it's, like, a legitimate space compact phion in, like, 6 slides.
Okay.
I'll wait. Okay. All right. I mean, it's not going to be the answer you're expecting or wanting, but maybe we could talk about that. But it's still going to be a strong motivation for it. Okay. So the D4 singularities. Why did we concentrate on these? So in particular, D4, the monodromy is just -1. So we know this takes rho to -rho/-1. So rho goes to rho, and tau goes to tau. And you might say, oh, well, that's, you know, you might say, well, what are you doing then? Is anything non-trivial actually going on? And there is something non-trivial going on. And I thought this would be a good point to explain that. I thought maybe this would be a good chance to talk about some of the things, that were just brought up. So these D4 singularities, you could then look at, say, these, I don't know, like E7 and A. These are different A1s than the A1s up here. They're non-standardly oriented. I don't know exactly what that means, but this A1 here, if you look at the monodromy, and you square this, you're going to get -1. So you might say, oh, well, 2 of these is going to give me a D4 if you put them on top of each other. And that is the case. But you might also say, well, wouldn't 2 E7s do the same thing? And the answer is no. And one of the ways to see that is if you put 2 A1s on top of each other, the order of their discriminant vanishing is 6, as it should be. But if you put 2 E7s on top of each other, the order of the discriminant doesn't match. So now maybe we can use this A1 intuition to see if something non-trivial is happening. And one way to see this is, well, what's the A1? A1 takes rho to -1/rho. So A1 takes rho to -1/rho. And once we've done this, there's this. So what is rho to -1/rho? As we discussed earlier, T-duality on both fibers takes rho to -1/rho and tau to -1/tau. So if rho goes to -1/rho, you also have to throw in a 90-degree rotation of your torus to get tau to go back to tau, right? So, but since we have 2 A1 singularities, we're going to do this twice. So we're doing 180-degree rotation of our torus. So what's happening here is, if you're a brain and you're living on this space, by the time you get back, the torus has been flipped over and you're going to be an anti-brain. So even though rho and tau aren't changing, there is this funny behavior because there's this 180-degree flip. Okay. So, all right, so this is what we did. And we came up with the very creative name 12 plus 12 prime model. The prime is for the rho singularities, and the unprime is for tau singularities. You have to mix them. So if you start with just tau singularities, this is just the geometric symmetries of your torus. This has nothing to do with string theory. I mean, it does in the sense that string theory lives here, but there's nothing stringy going on. So if you just had like a 12 plus 12 model, you're just going to end up with some four-dimensional internal space. In particular, it's going to be a K3. So if you just had rho singularities, if you did 12 plus 12 prime, you could always T-dualize, and you'd be back to this purely, you'd have a purely geometric intuition of what was going on. So we want to mix them. So this way, if we try to titleize and get out, we always have both row and tile similarities. Okay? Okay. So this is what we did, and we looked at, you can just glue these together asymptotically, using these Weierstrass equations, like here. And the way you do that is just define tau as the inverse of the modular function for this Weierstrass equation, and rho is the inverse of the modular function for this Weierstrass equation. Everything we're doing here is very similar to what was done in this stringy cosmic strings paper by Green and Yao and everyone else, Vafa and so this guy named Vafa. And they kind of took a different, they started off by saying, look, the string theory, rho and tau has these funny jumps in it. It's a pain to deal with. Let's just work with the modular function and then invert it this way instead of building it out. But it's very similar. So this is the model we built. And then we wanted to understand the physics on there. And so the first thing we did was look at the spectrum. And there's still this question of whether or not this is legitimate to do. But I'll be getting to that. So I want to talk a little bit about the spectrum, just because I think it really, it gives you a little bit more intuition of what's going on. And also, it was important. It ends up being a very important part of what we end up concluding. So one of the interesting things is, well, you might ask, well, what components to the spectrum do you get from the reduction of the Ramon-Neurone fields? And you can relate the kinds of fields you get in six dimensions to something that's purely a topological question on the base. And this is pretty easy to see. These here are like Betty numbers, but they have some particular bundle-valued cohomology, I guess is the correct words. Because so this minus and this plus is the eigenvalue under inversion of the torus. So if one of these fields has one leg along the torus and you invert it, you're going to pick up a minus sign. But if there's zero or two legs along the torus and you invert the torus, you're not going to pick up a minus sign. So examples of this, you could just say, well, what if I had A1 with my leg along the fiber? Well, you can come over here and say on the base, that's going to be a scalar. It's going to have this eigenvalue. But then you also know that's going to be a scalar in six dimensions. And what if I had A1 along the base? Well, now we have a vector in the base, and it's going to have a plus. But now it doesn't have any legs along the fiber. So when you invert the torus, you have a plus sign under inversion of the torus. And you can build up this way, and then you can count up the number of tensors and vectors in terms of these numbers. And it just reduces to figuring out what these numbers are. And for this particular example, you can construct some of these things explicitly. The easiest thing to do is, we had talked about, I had mentioned this 12 plus 12 model where you're actually just building a K3. Well, you know what the answers are for K3. So we can go through and use the intuition we get from what we know for the K3 to find out what the answers are for 12 plus 12 prime. And I'll give an example of this in a second. For a different part of the spectrum. But I have this up here. I figured it was a good point to give you some idea, another way to look at some of these numbers. So you might say, well, what if I had a zero brain just living off in my non-compact space? Well, that's going to be, you can come up here and you can say, oh, well, that's going to be, I think I went too high. So I have a zero brain living in some non-compact space. So this is going to be a vector in six dimensions. And it's related to B0 plus. So on a K3, you know, that's just going to be 2. So that counts how many of these there's going to be. However, you could also say, what's the same thing in the 12 plus 12 prime model? So as I was just arguing, a zero brain is going to be a zero brain, but as it moves around, it's going to be an anti-zero brain. So the zero brain gets confused. It looks in one direction. It sees its back, and they realize there's an anti-brain there, and you've broken supersymmetry by yourself in some sense. And so you can come and look at what B0 plus is over here, and as we found, it's zero as it should be. That's your intuition. I should say, I hadn't thought about it that way until I was discussing it with Andrew. So that's a good thing. So how can you use K3 to figure some of these things out? Well, I'm going to give a quick example here where you can consider the gauge fields on the base coming from the vector representation of our symmetry group. And so the first thing we're going to do is look for connections which are going to induce the desired monodromy. And it's pretty easy to show this is going to do that as long as Q here is some odd integer. However, any odd integer is not going to do. We need to know exactly what Q is. So now for K3, we can say, well, we can look at that Tia-Singer index theorem, and we know on a K3 this is 0, and this is going to be 10, and this is pretty easy to calculate. This is just the dimension of your representation, which is 2, and this is the Euler characteristic on the base. It's a sphere, so that's also 2. And this integral just trivially reduces to an integral around each of the degenerate points. And you end up with this, and you find that Q is minus 3. So now you can go back and plug Q equals minus 3 into the index theorem for the 12 plus 12 prime model. And it's basically the exact same calculation, except for the dimension of your representation is now 4, because you have both D4 and D4 prime singularities. And you find that H10 is 20, or B1 is just 40. So you have this part of the spectrum is going to contribute 40 real scalars. So, of course, if we're going to do physics, we care about the spectrum, but it's perhaps not the most exciting thing to get up talk about in front of the talk, in a talk. But the reason I'm talking about it, and Steve, this is my half answer to your question, is at the end of the day, you find out the number of tensors is 9 and vectors is 8, and hypermultiplets are multiplets. I'm saying tensors. I mean tensor multiplets, and not is 20. And the reason we care is that this particular linear combination gives you 273. So if that doesn't excite you, it should, because this is required to cancel an anomaly. And so 273 is a really weird number. It's not 2 or 1/2 or 4. It's not even 3. It's a weird number. And I think if what we were doing was not a legitimate string compactification, it would be pretty strange to just come up with a number like 273.
Yeah, now I can refer to one. So, if you go near one of these singularities and look at the geometry, mm-hmm. First of all, I guess there's the question of what the geometry is doing and how you see that's a solution of the supergravity equations, approximately. And then, secondly, there's the question of, as you go to the singularity, it's singular.
Right.
So it's got to be a singularity that is resolved by some springy object, and I want to know what that is. And you told me in one case it's a 5-frame.
Okay.
Okay. I'm wondering about this more.
All right. So I'll answer the ones I can, and so for starters, what are the objects? Well, okay, what's happening with the geometry? So there's
locally, does it look just like the local geometry near a 5-frame?
On some of the degenerations.
Okay.
But the particular nice thing about the 5-brain degenerations is those are the A series. and we know how to deal with the A series. Whereas the D and the E series, we don't actually know what the geometry is. We were actually complaining about this paper earlier. There's a paper by, it's a very good paper by Myers and Johnson, where their abstract says, so there's this original paper by Douglas and Moore, this D-brains, quivers, and ALE instantons, and they talk about resolving these spaces, and then this paper by Myers and Johnson says, well, we extend this construction to like find the explicit solution for the D and the E series. And you go through the paper and they start talking about how difficult it's going to be to do the D and the E series. And then at the end of the paper, they say, well, therefore we couldn't do it. So the explicit, an understanding geometry explicitly is not known for these D and E series. Okay. But the, I haven't done like a lot of work on this, or any, I guess, like explicitly. But I mean, it is the case, right? If you take like orbifolds, like these D and E, with these D and E singularities, you can discuss the string theory on just strings on those points, and that's what this paper by Douglas and Moore did for us. So since we know. I don't know what to tell you as far as what the object is, but it is a known thing how strings behave on those points.
Let me ask, and I'm sort of also trying to understand this, but there's another question you could ask. I mean, already away from the singular point, these solutions have a very strange geometry,
mm-hmm.
right? Because as you explained, I mean, you can have a torus, which you go around this point, and suddenly, you know, the torus is much bigger.
Right.
All the radii contained on it, the radii or something. So there's no smooth geometrical description even away
right.
from the singular points. But there, and we're not looking for an object to resolve it, we just know there's symmetries of string theory, which make that okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. So even if this sort of solution was not resolved at the point, wouldn't you just call this a singular solution of string theory? Throw it out as not a solution because there happens to be.
I
well, someone has told me before that not all singularities are allowed in
string. Right. So, but I think this is the point though. You're right. Not all singularities would be allowed in string theory. I'm sure whoever told you that has wonderful students. So there's the question, is this allowed? And this is my argument. This 273 comes from like looking at anomalies and supergravity, and all the analysis we did here is based on understanding the spectrum at these points. I'm saying, yes, it's not obvious that this is going to be a legitimate singular space to work on.
Well, you're saying it satisfies one consistency check, basically.
Yes. I mean, it's not obvious that this is 100% clear, but I mean, this would be a weird thing to happen. You know, I mean, what we did didn't have to work at all. And so, I mean, there might be some other funny reason this works, but I mean, this is something that would be interesting, is what other consistency checks do we need to look at, and are these really and truly legitimate string compactifications? This is strong motivation, and actually, I'm going to give you more motivation in a second, but I'll get to that. So,
what they're doing here, the weird thing that they're doing is sewing together this D4, the D4 prime solution, but you can sew them together far away from the singularities. In the singularity, there's nothing weird about them at all. If you look at them in this point of view that it's rho going to some, you know, modular transformation of rho, that can look pretty weird. But you can always, in string theory, you know, take the mirror of that, where it's tau going to some modular transformation of tau. Well, and these are just ALE singularities of K3, that they're genuine singularities, but everyone knows how to deal with string theory with ALE singularities.
Are there real orbifold singularities? Yeah, it doesn't look like, I mean, the way you're
well,
also get the resolution of orbital
So in some sense, you can resolve them locally, which is what Oliver's saying, but...
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, but then...
So the on one end, you can have them, you know, here it's tau doing something weird, and here it's rho doing something weird. Yeah. But locally, if you just look very near where rho is doing something weird, you can do the mirror again and think of it as tau. So you know that locally, string theory is going to be able to deal with each set of singularities. It's just that you're sewing together in the middle, you know, the one and also its mirror. And that's what's sort of unusual that these guys have done. But I don't think the singularities themselves are a problem for string theory. At all.
So if there are the full singularities, for example, they're pretty mild.
It's K3.
I mean, in some sense, if you went back to the first slide, this on the base, the curvature, the conformal factor is blowing up, but it's blowing up as like the natural log of the natural log. You know, it is something that's going up. All right, so that's some motivation of what we're doing makes sense. So I'm almost done. We can start asking, you know, what about dual theories and what's the right ways to think about these spaces? And I think the right way to think about these spaces are as blow-ups of asymmetric orbifolds. And this is something, you know, this is kind of exciting because we didn't even know how to ask what the blow-up of an asymmetric orbifold was before. You know, we didn't have some, you know, with the orbifolds, we know how to blow them up, but we don't have some geometric idea of what an asymmetric orbifold is. So as a blow-up of an asymmetric orbifold, it seems very, you know, it's nice to have something that can be thought of this way. In particular, one of the things, if you look at this particular asymmetric orbifold, which I've written down here, you find out this has the same spectrum that we found for our 12 plus 12 prime model. So, and you can think about what's going on is you have at each of the fixed points of your alpha action, you have a D4, and at each of the fixed points of the beta action here, which also includes these non-trivial effects. There's a minus one to the F left on the beta action. At these fixed points, we have these resolved D4 primes. So that's another way to think about these spaces. We also you talk about if you can do an 11-9 flip and perform a t-duality and you end up in type 2b, and then that can be described by a non-geometric F theory. So there are other ways to think about this. So as far as future work, one thing it'd be interesting to do is try to extend it to a six-dimensional internal space. Doing T3 fibers, it's hard to figure out the right way to, you don't have this nice Kodaira classification. It's not even clear how to break up your complex coordinates because it's 3 and 3. I mean, we talked a little bit about doing strange things, but it's difficult to figure out the right way to break up your complex coordinates. So the easiest thing to do might be to have K3 fibrations instead of T2 fibrations. You might also want to ask about D-brains on these spaces. In particular, can you categorize them some way? I mean, can you classify them? Like, is there an analog to derived categories? You might want to ask, can you put D-brain probes on these spaces? What is it going to, can you learn more about them this way? You might want to know what, figure out if there's analog to Geppner points, if we can get a handle on the world sheet CFTs for these spaces. And there's really a lot more. I mean, these seem like what we've done here is construct an entirely new class of legitimate string compactifications, which or arguably legitimate string compactifications. And I mean, this is pretty exciting. You know, we start off wanting to fix moduli. We fix some moduli. But I mean, I really think the exciting part is now there is this whole new class of spaces that you can compactivize string theory on. And it's interesting to see, you know, what we can learn from them. And I'll start with Andrew, and then.
Yeah, just to comment, I guess another reason you might think these are legit is that, well, Mike Schultz was here talking about the TULEs of the ISD flux compactifications. If you take two TULEs instead of three, you end up with something that looks a lot like this. So this is mentioned in the paper he had out recently, and also by Becker and
Dustin. Yeah. They look a lot like these, but they haven't been trying to do the same.
No, the similarities are pretty striking.
Yeah, I mean, I think with
the
Another reason you might think that is that these and the flux compactifications fall into duality.
Aller?
I just have an infinite number of questions, but to start, when you say non-geometric F theory,
this is new.
F theory was in the magnitude of 12 dimensions, you compactify some multiply manifold that was lifted with fiber, and you kept the complex structure.
Right.
But there was no Kähler structure of that auxiliary torus, and of course there was no B field. So there's no analog to the fact that you had tau and rho. And you could have monodromies of both and sew them together. In F theory, you really only have tau. So I don't see what the analog there is.
This was about two sentences in, that's not true. It's actually a paragraph in the paper, which I did not write this paragraph.
Which of your collaborators should I bug?
I would bug John. He seemed very convinced this is legitimate.
I mean, if you can do an 11-9 flipment, I mean,
you can do the dualities, get to 2B. The right way to interpret it as an F theory once you're in the 2B theory is that was where that's the jump I missed. But it's related. Talk to John. Send John an email.
Maybe these become 2B compactifications under all these dualities with more than just geometry and the axion delton turned on. Yeah, okay, it's probably F theory plus.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not. I mean, there wasn't non-geometric F theory before, so it's plus something. So that, yeah. I mean, send John an email. He would love to talk to you about this. okay. So.
When Kedaira had this classification on those A's and B's and E's. Where does that come from? Is that orbifolds?
So how did Kedaira did this a very different way than I learned to understand it? I mean, Kedaira, I'm not sure. He did what he did. I think was probably much more elegant, but also more. There was a lot of words I didn't understand in his paper,
I don't understand.
But so So there's three parts. There's first, there's getting from the generations of F and G to the monodromies, and then getting from that to these ADE classifications. And I guess the way I started was looking for these sections, looking for like vector potentials, like we had mentioned, which induce the monodromy we want. And then from that, you can find out the explicit form of F and G in terms of your periods in the Weierstrass P function. So you have this infinite sum over these periods, and you can get the explicit form of that, and then you can look at once you find these sections from that, you can find your periods and how they depend on Z, and then you can plug that into the forms of the F and G which you had before and see how those vanish and see how your discriminant vanishes. And then as far as relating it to ADE classifications, it's just an algebraic thing. If you have some curve, you can, you know, for the A singularities in particular, they're like x squared plus y squared plus z squared is equal to 0, right? So you can imagine starting with some elliptic equation and massaging it into some form that looks like this. And you can do a similar thing to determine the D and E.
This Pythagoras classification is just the usual statement that K3 manifolds have singularities that are SUN or SO2N or E67, E8. It's that same thing written in algebraic geometry.